alcoholic. My name is Doug.
Hi,
everybody. And I'm glad to be here, especially considering the ride I got from the airport. We almost had this meeting in Ankeny. My book tells me that I'm supposed to tell you what I used to be like. It says what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. Not what it used to be like, but what we used to be like. And to make a long story very short, I used to be a self-loathing drunk. And what happened was I took the steps. And today I'm self-respecting and sober. And that's it. I'm going to talk for an hour more or less. Because it's my story and I think it's fascinating. But if you want to leave, you just heard the good part. That's the message, as I understand it. I'm a dual problem. I was not addicted to any other illegal drugs, but in addition to being an alcoholic, I'm also an attorney. And that means that I tend to say things like, I speak for no group, or indeed for any other member, and certainly not for AA as a whole. The opinions expressed from this podium are personal opinions based on a private experience. And if you want what I have and are willing to go to any lengths to get it, you may need further therapy. That's what attorneys call a disclaimer. And what it really means is that I'm not responsible for anything else I have to say. And that allows me to be just as doctrinaire as I feel like being. And along those lines, I am a relatively dogmatic big book recovery. And I claim to be a relatively dogmatic big book recovery because I came to the unfortunate conclusion relatively recently in my sobriety that I'm not really big book. And I came to this conclusion because I was leading a big book study and I had made some comment during the meeting and I heard one of the group telling one of the people he sponsored that I was not really big book. And being a person who has outgrown resentment and who respects the principle of anonymity, I went to the offender's sponsor and said, did you know that Bill says that I'm not really big book? And Bill's sponsor said, well, don't worry about it. Bill's not really big book. So I worried about it. And I took it to somebody else and I said, did you know that Dell said that Bill is not really big book? Because Bill said that I'm not really big book. And the person I reported to said, don't worry about Dell. He's not really big book. So I became more confused about this, and I went to another friend of mine, and I said, Dick, did you know that Rock says that Dell is not really big book because Dell says that Bill is not really big book because Bill says that I'm not really big book, and Dick said, don't worry about it. Dell is not really big book. And I went back to my sponsor and said, did you know that Dick says that you're not really big book? And he said, don't worry about it. He's not really big book. I went home worried about it, and I came to the conclusion that you're not really big book until somebody says you ain't. And what that means is that you've internalized the principles to the degree that you can hold your own opinion without hesitation, apology, or equivocation, and that alone makes you really big book. So if you disagree with anything you hear from this podium, it's probably an indication that you're getting better. I came to AA as a result of an intervention. Those of you who've been through treatment are probably familiar with intervention. This is a treatment procedure by which they confront the alcoholic with the facts about his or her drinking in the hopes that this process will cause him to look at his drinking and maybe come to a conclusion, help him break down the denial, which is a principal symptom of the disease. A lot of people in AA are in doubt as to whether intervention works. I can tell you honestly that it does. I set up an intervention on one of my clients, and as a result of that process, I got sober. I haven't seen him since, but that's his problem. I was self-employed, and the difference between the self-employed and the unemployed is that the self-employed have an office in which to stay unemployed. And I had a client. And I had determined that this guy was not a pathological criminal. It seemed that every time he got in trouble, he'd been drinking shortly before he got in trouble. And I came to the conclusion that Dave was not a pathological criminal. Dave was a simple alcoholic. And that we ought to help him get some help. So I did what I understand to be one of the best treatment modalities suggested to professionals in the field. I called his employer and suggested this intervention. And the employer thought it was a good idea, and he said, "How do we start?" And I said, "Well, let's start at the Steak and Ale at 11:30 and bring your American Express card." And we did, and we had 3 martinis before lunch, and I told him I thought we ought to go talk to Dave. And we had 3 martinis for lunch, and he asked when and where, and I said, "Well, we could start this afternoon." We had 3 martinis after lunch. And it got to be about time to go. And when I got to AA, people told me something that they often tell newcomers, and maybe it frightened some of you. It didn't frighten me because it happened to me every day. They said, "You're going to have to change 180 degrees. Everything about your life must change." And I thought, okay, what else is new? Every day at around 2:30 in the afternoon, I'd go from being the only drunk at the Steak and Ale to being the only attorney at a place called the Bissonette Totem. And I'd waltz in and straighten my tie, kind of pull my coat down around my shoulders and sit there and feel superior. And then when I'd go home, which was whenever they'd close, you know, my long-suffering Al-Anon would meet me at the door and say, "Where have you been?" And I'd say, "Well, I've been at the Bissonette Totem." And she'd say, "Why do you stay there every day until they close?" And I said, "Well, you don't understand. We are not," and at the time this was true, "we are not permitted to advertise for legal services. So I have to do some practice development." And the neat thing about the Bissonette Totem is that every son of a bitch over there has legal problems. They're all getting arrested. They're all getting sued. They're all getting divorced. Of course, they don't count everybody at the Bissonette Totem who has legal problems. But I was accustomed to going from being the only drunk at the Steak and Ale to being the only attorney at the Bissonette Totem. And on January 16th, 1976, when the time came to stop being the only drunk at the Steak and Ale, we didn't go to the Bissonette Totem. We went down to the shop to do this confrontation on Dave. And I stopped Richard on our way down there, and I said, "There's one thing we need to do first." And he said, "What's that?" I said, "Well, we need some beer." And he said, "What's that for?" So I told him, I said, "You see, when we talk to Dave about his drinking, that's going to make him nervous. And some of y'all might wonder how it is that I knew that." I just put it down to divine intuition. And I said, "At least if we have some beer, he'll know that we're not being judgmental. And then he can relax." So we got a case of Cold Miller High Life. Which, by my standards, is enough to relax any alcoholic. And we got down to the shop to do the confrontation, and I said, "Well, Dave, would you like a beer?" And, of course, he wanted one, so I became obliged to have one with him. And I would like to be able to tell you that I told him that I thought he ought to cut down, that if he couldn't cut down without help, he ought to quit, and if he couldn't quit without help, he ought to call AA. But the reason that I cannot tell you whether or not that is in fact what I told him is that that's when I went into a blackout. And I came out of this blackout in a court of law, looking at a criminal complaint, and coming to the realization that there's good news and bad news about this situation. The good news is I am not the defendant. The bad news is I'm not entirely sure who is. And the city attorney came over to me and said, "Doug, you're drunk." And I said, "No shit." And he said, "Is your client here?" And I said, "I don't know." I'm only a lawyer in Texas. I don't know how it works in Iowa, but generally in Texas, when we enter the plea bargaining process, we know what the deal is before we agree to it. On this occasion, my friend Herb said, "I'm going to dismiss this ticket on one condition," and I said, "You got it. What is it?" He said, "You have your client drive you home." And I said, "You're on, buddy." So we got out in the hall and I got introduced to my client. And they asked him to wait until they checked with Hit and Run, made sure I didn't kill anybody on my way down there. And I'm standing there about to ride home with a guy who's about to be tried for a speeding ticket as a habitual violator. Of course, he was a better driver than I was. But this is embarrassing, so I kind of straightened my tie and looked him as close to straight in the eye as I physically could and said, "Do I look drunk to you?" And he said, "Yes." And I said, "Well, that's not really the point. Do I look wall-sliding, ditch-crawling drunk?" And he said, "Yes." So I said, "That was good." And he said, "How do you figure that?" And I told him, I said, "See, you're just obviously guilty. You got a radar ticket for speeding through a school zone. And you just can't beat these things with a jury trial. You're just guilty. But sometimes these things are dismissed due to the intoxication of counsel." Well, the neat thing about that was he believed it. So I had him take me to my office. You know how we are. I had agreed to go home, and the first thing I did was go to my office. I had told the prosecutor that I would go home, but I couldn't go there because my wife lives there. And I got back to the office, and I got rid of this client, and I got to thinking, and you know, that's always dangerous. And something then happened to me that I have to attribute to a power greater than myself, which today I no longer hesitate to call the grace of God. The reason I say this is I know that I was too drunk to walk. My evidence for that conclusion is that I had an office 50 feet from a beer joint, and I could not get down the hall, out the door, and 50 feet. I had to send my landlord to buy me what has been to date my last drink. And on the basis of that evidence, I know that I was too drunk to walk. And knowing that I was too drunk to walk, I suspect that I was too drunk to think. And yet, being in a condition in which I was too drunk to think, I was allowed to see some of the truth about just the last 6 months of my drinking. And in fact, I had had some excuses for drinking, which turned out upon relatively superficial examination to be problems that were in fact caused or contributed to by my drinking. For example, my marriage was about to come apart. And I had rationalized that as I had married the wrong person. You know, we had religious and cultural differences. And that marriage had never been any good in the first place. And that night, something within but not of me said, "You have become a chronic bedwetter." And besides that, you generally wet her side of the bed. And if you were otherwise a saint, that by itself would make you difficult to get along with. And of course, I couldn't make a living, and I blamed that on the government. You know, it's hard to be self-employed in a socialist country. And that night, that inner voice said, the reason you aren't making a living is that you don't want to work more than about 30 minutes a day. And it's generally hard to get paid if you don't work. You know, I had, of course, been arrested, and that was due to the lack of training and indiscretion of the Houston police. And that night, I was allowed to see that I was attempting to explain one of the finer points of constitutional law to an armed Houston police officer who was in the process of making an arrest in the middle of a public street in a Spanish-speaking neighborhood at 3 o'clock in the morning. And this was not the sort of thing I would have done if I had not been a little bit intoxicated at the time I chose to do it. They take a dim view of that. They call that interference with the police. And then I'd had a little problem with front-end alignment. I had a car that tended to pull off to the right. And that night, this inner voice said, your car is a little bit harder to control after a six-pack of Schlitz. So I came to the conclusion that I had to do something about my drinking, and I knew that I didn't want to come to AA because the only thing I knew about you was that you couldn't drink. And I honestly hoped I never got that bad. So I hit the first of a series of drunk traps that have convinced me that this program is divinely inspired. I called my pastor, and he called an alcoholic. And I ended up in AA. In spite of my own best efforts at having a word of prayer and becoming a recovered social drinker. And that was the beginning of something that I have to believe was strictly by the grace of God. I came to my first meeting convinced that AA was a refuge for people who got thrown out of the Salvation Army, and that I was probably going to be the youngest and, of course, the best educated and probably the wealthiest, and, well, maybe I could help you, you know. And I was convinced that in case there would be somebody there that might recognize me, that I wanted to use my middle name so that they would go home and tell their wife there was a fellow there named Norm that looked a hell of a lot like Doug DeBakey. And I was prepared to bounce a check. I had my little pocket checkbook with me, and I knew you had a $100 initiation fee. Because I had joined, you know, everything. I can tell you easily what I'm not, you know, or not entirely. I'm not entirely an Episcopalian or a member of the Disciples of Christ or a Unitarian or a Roman Catholic or a member of the Eastern Orthodox Church. I'm not entirely a Republican, Democrat, or Libertarian. I'm hardly at all a member of my Civic Improvement Association. But everything I'd joined and tried to join had an initiation fee, and I was convinced you were no different, and I was willing to bounce a check to get in. I figure if it's good enough for Safeway, it's certainly good enough for Alcoholics Anonymous. And the next drunk trap I hit after my pastor turned me over to AA, which I thought was greatly unfair, was they read the preamble. Same preamble that you heard read here tonight. And they told me things like, there are no dues or fees for AA membership. And I knew that I could relax because I wasn't going to be allowed, required or even allowed to run a con on you people. There had been someone who got here before I did that set it up where I wouldn't have any excuses. You know. And they said, the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. And I had a qualified desire to stop drinking. My original game plan was to stop for 6 months and get out of debt. And I've been sober since the 16th of January, 1976, which is about 11 years and 6 months more than the 6 months I was shooting for when I got here. And I now owe more money to more people than they would let me borrow. So my way didn't work. But in the course of that 6 months, by the grace of God, I came to believe that I had a disease. And when I came to believe that I had a disease, I had to recognize that I needed a solution. And at first I thought it was a matter of, well, you know, let's stay sober one day at a time. The old party line, don't drink, go to meetings. You know, well, you can not drink and go to meetings for a while, but it's a little like putting a Band-Aid on a bullet wound. And in the course of don't drink and go to meetings, I came to the realization that I had a terminal illness. And that's the way the doctors tell us that we're going to die. You know, they call it terminal. And it was hard for me to believe that I didn't have enough brain and liver cells left to live a long time, but I was beginning to pick fights with people who carry knives. And my fantasies of suicide always ended in failure. You know, the overdose ended with a stomach pump in the emergency room. And I'd think, you know, if I put a gun to my head, I might end up blind but not quite dead. And jumping out of a building was attractive until I realized that if I ended up in a wheelchair but not dead, I'd be dependent on a long-suffering Al-Anon to bring me my beer for the rest of my life. And for fear of failure, failed to try the first thing I probably would have done right. Yeah. And then they tell you fear is a character defect. But I got to AA and I was beginning to carry those fantasies through to a successful completion. And the other thing I was in the habit of doing had to do with that old car with a problem with front end alignment. I routinely drove because I was too drunk to walk. And I'd always get in the right hand lane with no lights. And, you know, I figured, hey, if I can't see them, they can't see me. And they're not going to stop you if you're invisible. But, you know, there's always some fool that parks his car in the curb lane. And when you're driving with no lights, you don't see it until it's too late. And it occurred to me that I wasn't going to live long enough to die from alcoholism. I was on my way to becoming a homicide, suicide, or accidental death. And only if I was lucky enough and healthy enough to finally hit the skids would I die from alcoholism. But when sobriety became a matter of life and death, recovery became very much more interesting than it had previously been. And they suggested you get a sponsor. I love this program. You know, they tell you things that you really need to know, like what is a sponsor? I thought I'd have to go out and collect affidavits from people who were willing to say that I was a terrible drunk. And they said, no, we'll take your word for that. They said, you go out and find somebody who has 24 hours more sobriety than you have and who has what you want. And you ask them how they got it. And if they're working a program, they'll tell you. So I found a man with 3.5 years of sobriety and a Cadillac. And he started me out on some of these contradictions in our program that just don't make any sense. Still don't, you know. I love it. You know, you sit down in an AA club and get a cup of coffee, and the first person that comes by will ask you how long you've been here, and if you tell them 30 days or less, they'll pat you on the shoulder and say, hang on. And by the time you get your second cup of coffee, the next fool that comes by says, let go. And they say, well, all you need to do is stop drinking. And you say, but I can't. And they say, we know. I think possibly my favorite is don't make any major decisions for a year. And then they turn around and say, we want you to take third step. What's the third step? Made a decision. Wait a minute. I'm not supposed to get a divorce or a job, but I'm supposed to get a God. You know. But that's part of the deal. You know, you come to AA and they say, now look, this is Alcoholics Anonymous. We're a bunch of brain-damaged neurotics and pathological liars. We want you to trust us. My sponsor gave me a big book and said, read this book slowly and deliberately, asking yourself what it means to you. And I said, what do you mean by slowly and deliberately? And he said, well, it took me 6 weeks to read the page that says other books. And I started to read slowly and deliberately. Got into the doctor's opinion and discovered that he talked about the physical aspect of the disease and the phenomenon of craving. I'm here today to explain to you that there are five categories of alcoholics in the doctor's opinion. This is one of the drunk traps in the big book. They talk about five categories of alcoholics, beginning with sociopaths. I think he called them psychopaths in those days. And they go down to type 4, which is manic depressives. And then there's type 5, who are perfectly normal in every respect except for the fact that they drink too much. Well, of course, I was a type 5. The drunk trap in that is once you classify yourself as type 5, you put yourself on the list. They talked about the first step. They talked about being powerless over alcohol, that our lives were unmanageable. And what's that supposed to mean to anybody? To me, it's simple. To be powerless over alcohol is to state that I have a body that can't take it. If I start drinking, I am smitten by a compulsion which compels me to keep drinking, which is no problem, as long as I don't take the first drink. But I also have a mind that can't leave it alone, which is a problem. And there's good news and bad news about early sobriety. The good news is assuming that your heart, your lungs, your liver, and your kidneys are functioning approximately as they are intended to. After 72 hours after your last drink, you're about as sober as you're ever going to be. The bad news is that's when your mind kicks in. Having a body that can't take it is no problem as long as you don't have a mind that can't leave it alone, which I had, and then that's a drunk trap to get you into step 2, which suggests that you're insane, which is an insult, but the only reason you need to accept it is the only thing that's at stake is your life. And step 2 says simply that we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. I had no problem with the word God. I had a God. Or at least I thought I had a God. But the God I thought I had was a being that was going to be interested in my life about 3 days after I died. And then he was going to add up the good and the bad and see whether or not I won. And when I came to AA, I was willing to tell you that I was a professing believer, but I was a functioning agnostic. Because while I said I believed in God, I acted as if there were no God. And today I'm much less certain what I believe. So AA has completely reversed my notion of spirituality. I came here a professing believer and a functioning agnostic. Today I'm a professing agnostic and a functioning believer. And through step 2, I came to realize that I had to find a power greater than myself, and they suggested that I go on from there. They said, the first step is the problem, the second step is the solution, and the third step is no more than the decision to go for the solution. And at this point, I began to get into an aspect of sponsorship that I call remedial reading. See, I read the third step, and I thought it said, turned, T-U-R-N-E-D, past completed, our will and our lives, and then I dropped in a parenthetical clause that's not there, from this day forward, close parentheses, and tried to do it that way and didn't succeed. And I got back to my sponsor, and he said, you have missed 3 words. And I said, oh, what are they? And he said, the first 3 words. Made a decision. And step 3 for me is the beginning of the process that leads to what I call recovery. And that is no more than the decision to go for the solution. Knowing that the problem is alcoholism, a body that can't take it, governed by a mind that can't leave it alone, and that the solution is God, there are only 2 possible decisions, and one is to go on blotting out the consciousness of our intolerable condition the best we can. The other is to accept spiritual help, as indicated in the third step. By this time, I was beginning to be aware that there was a reason that the big book received a lot of lip service in Alcoholics Anonymous, and that it might be a good idea to read it and see what it suggested. And I got to page 63, and there's a suggested form of words for the third step. They go on to say that the wording was entirely optional as long as we expressed the idea without reservation, but they further suggested that it was desirable to take this step with an understanding person, such as our wife, best friend, or spiritual advisor. So I went down that list and said, my wife is a missionary atheist, my best friend is a dog, and I'm still too proud to go to my spiritual advisor and tell him that after 7 years in his church and 2 years on the Sunday school board, I know nothing about God. So I found what I thought was a loophole where it said it's better to meet God alone than with someone who might misunderstand. And having eliminated everyone on the list, I thought I'd better meet God alone. And because the wording was entirely optional, I used it exactly and attempted to do the third step by myself. When I got down to step five, I had a drunk trap. On page 74 of a second or third edition of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and on God knows what page of a first edition, it says that those of us belonging to a religious denomination which requires confession must, and of course will want, to go to the duly appointed authority whose duty it is to receive it, and that even though we have no such affiliation, we might still do well to talk with someone ordained by an established religion, although we often encounter people who might misunderstand. Well, I got sober in a preacher's living room. So when the book suggested I do this fifth step with someone ordained by an established religion, I knew that he would not misunderstand. And on the top of page 75, it says, once we have selected the person who is to hear our story, we waste no time. We tell him what we are about to do and why we have to do it. So I made an appointment with my pastor to do the fifth step, and I showed up with my written inventory, and I told him, well, look, I stopped drinking and I got an AA, and they told me to take these steps, and I made this decision, and then I had to write this inventory, and now I have to bring it to you. And so what I finally accidentally did was that in the process of doing the fifth step halfway the Big Book way, I accidentally did the third step right, because I shared my decision with my spiritual advisor. So for me, step five became a drunk trap for people that didn't take step three properly. And I'm convinced that the Big Book was divinely inspired, because the process itself is so complete that there are drunk traps there for people who are looking for loopholes. And I haven't found any other suggested method of recovery, including that suggested in the 12 and 12, that provides these safety nets or drunk traps for people like me who are educated beyond their abilities. And if there's anything I disagree with in the Big Book, it's the statement that half measures will avail us nothing. I believe that I'm living proof that half measures will avail us something, on one condition, and the condition is that we attempt the half measures halfway the Big Book way. Because when I got to the end of step five, you know, there are some promises on the bottom of page 75 that are supposed to materialize when we've taken the fifth step withholding nothing, and none of them materialized. Primarily because I had admitted to God because he already knew, and to another human being because I thought I would get drunk if I didn't, but of course not to myself. Not even the exact nature of my wrongs, but a laundry list of misdeeds. And because I had not admitted these things even to myself, I didn't get the relief that's promised at the end of the fifth step. But I got into step six, and I'm sorry you don't have them here where everybody can read them, but for those of you who are fairly new, step six says, having discovered what it was that we did not like about ourselves, we set out by force of will to remake ourselves in our own image. And everybody that just laughed has attempted to do it just that way. Like New Year's resolution time. And the harder I tried to resolve, the less well I did, the less well I did, the less I liked myself, and the less I liked myself, the harder I tried to resolve, and then the less well I did, and the less well I did, the less I liked myself, and the harder I tried to resolve. Finally, I got back to a sponsor, and he said, do you have one of those little white cards? And I said, do you mean one of those with the steps and traditions on it? He said, yes. I said, yes. He said, read step six. What does it say? And I was flattered. I thought he was asking a professional opinion. I said, well, it says, we're entirely ready to have God. And he said, stop, read that again. We're entirely ready to have God. And he said, stop, read that again. We're entirely ready to have God. And he said, stop, read that again. When he began to realize that I was beginning to understand that I was only responsible to be entirely ready to have God do something, Then he let me read the rest of the step to find out what it was that I was ready to have God do. And when I got to the end of that process, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. He said, "Are you ready?" And I said, "What?" And he said, "Are you ready?" And I said, "Yes." Well, you see, that's one of those gentle hints for timing. It's on page 76 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. The introduction to the seven-step prayer says, "When ready." Isn't that neat? You know, well, we worry about when should I take the steps? You know, well, how soon do you want to get well? I mean, it's up to you. You have anywhere between 20 minutes after your last drink to 5 years after your last drink. The real deadline is sometime before your first drink. You know, if you get it, that's the deadline. If you get it done by then, you're right on schedule. Other than that, it's up to you. How long do you want to stay in a condition of untreated alcoholism without the benefit of alcohol or chemicals to make you feel better? I mean, that was the true nature of my disease. I've come to believe today that drinking for me was not the problem. Drinking was the solution. Alcohol was the substance I prescribed for my alcoholism. And after I stopped drinking, I was the same incompetent human being I had been before I started drinking, which, of course, was the reason I drank to begin with. So, you know, if you don't drink one day at a time and go to meetings, you're going to not drink one day at a time and go to meetings and wonder why people are staying very far away from you. See, an alcoholic, I'm fond of this parallel. An alcoholic is like a man who's standing on a bridge with his pants on fire. Except that the alcoholic would stand there and say, "I wonder how these pants got on fire. Was it hereditary or environmental?" Well, who cares? The point is, jump into the water. AA is not the water you jump into when your pants are on fire. AA is a bunch of idiots in a lifeboat with charred britches who provide swimming lessons for people whose pants are no longer on fire. And if you find out that now that you've stopped drinking, you don't know how to swim, get in the lifeboat. You'd be surprised how many of us get back up on the bridge and start playing with matches. But I got to the seventh step and it said, "When ready," and then there is a prayer that I recommend to every human being that comes into this fellowship, and if I have a message beyond don't drink, go to meetings, read the big book, and work with others, it's probably this. When I read the seventh step prayer, I began to have a spiritual awakening. Because there's a sentence there that made me aware of a degree of spirituality of which I had not previously been aware. It said, "When ready," we say something like this, "My Creator, I am now willing that you should have all of me, the good and the bad," and there's a period at the end of that sentence. We go on to say that I'm willing to have God remove every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to Him and my fellows. But when I got to the end of the first sentence, I realized that I was going to give Him the good and the bad. Which meant that I wasn't responsible even to judge which was which, because I was going to give God the whole ball of wax anyway. And somehow I'd gotten the notion through theological training or whatever that I was supposed to, the slogan in Texas is "Get Right with God," and what that meant to me was I had to clean up my act and bring Him the good. And AA was saying that I had the right idea, but I had the shoe on the wrong foot. What I needed to do was get with God and let Him get me right. And when I recognized that I was going to give Him the good and the bad and was not responsible even to judge which was which, a funny thing happened. I could finally admit to myself the exact nature of my wrongs. Because I could look at them in a morally neutral universe and ask, are they healthy or unhealthy? Not, are they good or bad, right or wrong, evil or, you know, but simply healthy and unhealthy. And with the ability to admit to myself the exact nature of my wrongs came the feeling that the drink problem had been removed. And where I had once had certain religious beliefs, I began to have a spiritual awakening. I discovered the ability to be alone at perfect peace and ease. And these, of course, are the promises that the book lists on page 75 as being supposed to materialize when we've taken the fifth step, withholding nothing. So for me, step 7 became a drunk crap for people that didn't do step 5. And I can verify that by saying that it was at that point that I got the promises that are supposed to materialize when we've done the fifth step. And here again, half measures. Half measures availed me something because the book itself, the process that was outlined by the Pioneer 100, was so perfect that I couldn't screw it up. I began to have an awareness of the difference between religion and spirituality. And I began at this point to be reconciled to my traditions. Some of y'all may have some problem with the difference between religion and spirituality, especially for new people. They tell me that there was a guy that died who had no denominational affiliation. And he found himself at the pearly gates, and St. Peter found his name on the list, and he said, "Hey, you're in. What was your denominational preference?" The guy said, "I don't know, I never had any." St. Peter said, "Well, let me show you around. When you find something you like, we'll let you stay there." And he opened a door, and there's a bunch of people sitting in hardback wood pews with the, you know, their ties are tight and their backs are straight and they're squinting at small print Bibles. And the fellow said, "These people look miserable. Who are these?" And St. Peter said, "Well, these are the Protestants. And they think this is joy." And the guy said, "Well, my God, I don't want any of this. Can you show me something else?" And St. Peter said, "Yeah, we have another room over here in which were a bunch of people praying the rosary on their knees as fast as they could, sweating at the brow, gasping for breath, bleeding fingernails." And the guy said, "These people look more miserable than those others." He said, "Who are these?" And St. Peter said, "These are the Catholics. And they think they're still trying to get in." The fellow said, "Oh my God, this is terrible. Do you have anything else up here?" And St. Peter said, "Well, let me show you this room over here." When the great saint opened the door, clouds of stale smoke and the smell of fresh coffee poured out the door. And within were a bunch of people laughing and scratching and drinking coffee and talking dirty and, you know, hugging on each other and having a good time. And the guy said, "Now this is more like it. I think I'd like to stay here." He said, "Who are these?" And St. Peter said, "It's a funny thing. We don't know. And they won't tell." But he said, "Our policy is to just leave them alone because they're only staying a day at a time." I sort of skipped over one part of the process, which is the fourth step. And there's a remarkable thing about the fourth step. They told me to look specifically for resentment, fear, selfishness, anger, these kinds of negative emotions which are the producing cause of my defects of character. And the first thing I needed before I could begin that process was a useful understanding of what those things meant. And for me, it's very simple. Resentment is the feeling I have when I am remembering that I did not get my way at some time in the past. Fear is the feeling I have when I don't think I'm going to get my way at some time in the future. And anger is the feeling I have when I'm not getting my way right now. And my defects of character are so mundane, human, and typical that they don't deserve much discussion. I'm a sorry, self-centered son of a bitch. And I'll step on you if you get in my way. And that's the way I was sober. See, I was relatively harmless while drinking. You know, I'd just sort of get drunk and pass out and wonder why the world was against me. Now I know. I'm convinced that the big book was divinely edited because it was written by 100 drunks using the committee system. Bill, who suffered from bleeding ulcers and chronic depression, would write a chapter and send it to the group in Akron. They would edit it and send it to the group in New York, who would edit it and give it back to Bill, who would rewrite it and send it to the group in Akron. And they'd rewrite it and send it to the group in New York, who gave it back to Bill, who rewrote it, and it got published. And it came out where even the punctuation is in the right places. Yeah. Ask yourself one simple question. Think back to your last group conscience meeting. And ask yourself, could my home group have written the big book? I can't speak for you, but I can tell you that the A-Leaf group takes 20 minutes to elect a general service representative when we have a volunteer. You know, if we tried to write a letter to New York, it wouldn't come out right. If we relied on the group conscience to write the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, we'd be lucky if we got the part about not drinking. And I'm convinced here again that there was a divine editor, and beyond that, that he had a sense of humor. And that's allowed me to become comfortable with this notion of spirituality. When I got to 8 and 9, I had this quandary about what that really meant. To make amends to the persons I'd harmed and why I had to do it. And I realized that that was the answer to my parenthetical clause. When I took the third step and made the decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I then understood Him, I already had a past. And how in the world are you going to turn over the past? And the way I discovered that we turn over the past is by making amends for the harm we've done to the extent it's still possible in the present, so that 8 and 9 for me are the completion of the process that began with the third step. Step 1 is only the statement of the problem. Step 2 is the statement of the solution. Step 3 is the decision to go for the solution. And then in 4 and 5 we find out what we're talking about, and in 6 and 7 we turn it over up to and including the conditions of the day on which we take those steps, and in 8 and 9 we turn over the past. And it's not by accident that the promises materialize on page 83 and 84. As if we are painstaking about this phase of our development, I believe that's in reference to the process of making amends, we'll be amazed before we're halfway through. We're going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it, and the rest. At that point, if you've taken the first 9 steps of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous to the best of your ability according to the method suggested in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, you have my permission and encouragement to call yourself a recovered alcoholic. Because I believe that at that point you've been through the process and you can give yourself credit for having turned it, meaning you, over, up to that point. And then there's good news and bad news at this point. The good news is you don't have to go back to the first 9. The bad news is 10, 11, and 12 are a drunk trap for people that didn't do the first 9 right. But I love this controversy we have about recovering and recovered and what it means and what it doesn't mean. And it's one of the finest meeting topics you can have. You know, we may wish to avoid controversy, but we don't always do it successfully. And one of my favorites is the recovering, recovered controversy. The recovering alcoholics dare the recovered alcoholics to go out and take 2 drinks and stop abruptly. The recovered alcoholics tell the recovering alcoholics to go home and read the book. You know. And nobody gets drunk. At least until after the meeting. And I think it's more important to know what we are not than it is to say what we are. I say I'm recovered because the language used by the authors of the big book, and I think we owe it to the general public and especially to newcomers to communicate to them that we have a real and effective solution for the problem of alcoholism. We have a guy in my home group who's been sober over 27 years and says he's recovering, and if I thought it took that long, I would drink. But I hope they don't believe when I say that I'm recovered that I think I can drink, because I understand that if I went out tonight and got in a fight and got shot, if I survived, at some point the wound would heal and the scar tissue would fade and I'd be able to say that I was a recovered gunshot victim. But that by itself would not make me bulletproof. If you are, as I am, on the recovered side of this non-issue, just keep in mind that you're not drink-proof, and you ain't going to be. What's important is that we are not cured, because that would imply a medical solution, and we are not reformed, because that would imply a moral problem. And I like recovered because of the positive aspect of the past tense. And I'm convinced that to keep what I have to stay in 10, 11, and 12, and on page 84 it tells me what to watch out for. It's continue to watch for resentment, fear, selfishness, and dishonesty. And then the next word in the next sentence is when, and the magic word in the 10th step is when. It says when and not if. When these crop up, tells me what to do. We ask God to remove them, discuss them with someone immediately, make amends quickly if we've harmed anyone. Then we direct our attention to what we can do for someone else. Another great non-controversy is what that paragraph really implies. I don't know, you may call yourself going back through 4 through 9. I call myself working the 10th step. It hardly matters. The principle is inventory. And if you're an alcoholic, you better be doing it. Untreated alcoholism is a killer. The 11th step for me was baffling because it suggested prayer and meditation. They said prayer is talking to God, and that part was okay. They said meditation is listening to God, and when I listen to God, they don't call it meditation. They call it paranoid schizophrenia. And I've had some tremendous experiences with inspiration. I got into a deal 6 years sober, in which we had the direct inspiration of the Spirit, and we knew the will of God, and we were going to achieve a financial miracle. The only problem with it was that people in my home group, whose opinions and attitudes I respected, told me it was a crack-brained scheme. But of course, that was because they had no faith. And instead of a financial miracle, we got sued. And then I got back to the simplicity of what's suggested in the second tradition, that a loving God may speak to us through the group conscience. I've come to believe today that that's exactly true for me, and that gives me the reasonable assurance that I can get in 1 hour of meditation even on a bad day. If I will come to a meeting willing to listen, a loving God will speak to me through the group, and there'll be a wino somewhere in the room who's going to say exactly what I need to hear. And I've developed a threefold test for the caliber of my inspiration. Now, if I have a good idea that seems to be the will of God, even if an angel comes to me in a dream and says, do it, I'd better run it past this test. And the first prong of the test is, does it make sense? Well, since my history proves that I don't know, I translate that into something that I can follow as, would a dog do it? If a dog would do it, the next part of my test is, does the group approve? And if a dog would do it and the group approves, the third part is, will it hurt anybody? If a dog would do it, the group approves, and it won't hurt anybody, do it. The worst thing that can happen under those circumstances is you'll have to go back and do a 10th step on it if it turns out to be wrong. Step 12 suggests that having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. For me, the spiritual awakening and the message are pretty much the same. I came to you people, and as a result of these steps, I had an awakening, which was an awakening in the same sense that when I get up in the morning and see the ceiling, it is not as if the ceiling was not there while I was asleep last night. It's just that I was not aware of it until I opened my eyes to the reality of the ceiling. And I came to you people with a feeling of worthlessness. And you said, no, wait. You are not worthless. You're sick. But for that, we have a solution. And when I could begin to accept the disease concept of alcoholism and the spiritual program for recovery, I came to an awakening to a sense of self-worth as a human being and child of God, made in His image. And that happens to be the message that I can most effectively carry to the next drunk, is simply to say, hey, you are not worthless. You may be sick, but for that there is a solution. When I try to carry that message, it never fails to reinforce my sobriety, whether the drunk hears it or not. I'm also extremely grateful that they use the word tried in the context of having tried to practice these principles in all our affairs, because I've discovered that most days I don't get to brag about how well I'm doing. But I know that if I can honestly say that I have tried to practice AA's principles in all my affairs, I can walk down the street with my head up and my shoulders back, not fearing to run into anyone, because I don't need to apologize to anyone for the way I'm trying to live my life today. And that, for me, is the 180-degree change from the way I came to you people in January 1976 that they were talking about. I want to bring you a little bit up to date on how it is now. Still practicing law. I'm practicing in a full partnership with my first wife. Still married. That's partly due to the grace of the Al-Anon program. If there are any Al-Anons here who think that you have maybe a derivative disease, and that now that your beloved is sober, that your problems are over, I wish to remind you that I had a very dear friend in the Al-Anon family groups who became, as many alcoholics become, complacent, stopped going to meetings, stopped sponsoring people, stopped working the steps, took her recovery for granted, and one night proved that carbon monoxide is at least as toxic and a hell of a lot quicker than alcohol. So if you're here and you're attracted to one of us, you know, believe me, you have a primary illness. And it can be terminal. And you can't afford complacency any more than we can. We went through a period where the old relationship died. We came in because we thought we needed each other. We worked on our own programs and came to the conclusion that no human being really needs any other human being, whether it's wife, employer, sponsor, or anything else, that human beings are just a notoriously poor higher power. They have a tendency to drink, change their minds, move to Chicago, die. I mean, a whole host of things human beings will do that will let you down. And once we were no longer mutually dependent, we went through the most dangerous period in the history of our marriage, which was a period of benevolent indifference. And we had become no longer mutually dependent and not yet in love, and we were sort of roommates. I had been told when we got married that marriage was a sacrament and that we would need the grace of God to make it work. And in my mind, that meant something dramatic would happen, you know, like an apparition of St. Joseph showing up in your living room and saying, "Knock it out." What happened for us was we ran out of money. And each of us would have filed for divorce if we had $500 to hire a good lawyer. Neither one of us had $500. So we survived the period of indifference. And then we found that we were still living together in spite of our individual intentions to cease living together. And we decided that maybe we were living together for a reason, although we didn't really understand what it was. And upon closer inspection, we decided that we were probably living together because we wanted to. And we had gone from being together because we thought we needed each other to a point where today we are together because we honestly want each other. And that's a miracle of recovery in a personal relationship. But if there's anybody here who's new in the program, that period of benevolent indifference came along after 2 years in AA and Al-Anon respectively. And that was the most dangerous period in our marriage. During the drinking, the disease was in control. And since then, recovery has allowed us to build a positive relationship. But I've discovered that very many families come into AA and approach recovery only to hit the period of indifference and break up. And my sponsor, who ought to know a lot about it because he's been married 11 times to 10 different women, was at that time my relationship advisor. And he said, "Give it time." I went to somebody else and he said, "You know, this is all based on if you want what we have and are willing to go to any lengths to get it, you'll take our advice." And he said, "I know you love your sponsor, but ask yourself, do you want what he has?" And that, friends, is a principle. If you become too dependent on any human being in Alcoholics Anonymous, do yourself a favor, take their inventory. You know? They say you don't take anybody else's inventory, but you got to stick with the winners. Well, my God, how are you going to know who they are if you don't take their inventory? The marriage has recovered. We're now in business as a full partnership. And we have a daughter. And I like to pass this on. I got one on the ground and one on the way. And that's it for us. I've decided that one is too many and two is enough. But the one on the ground may be, in some ways, my most effective 12th step. And I say that because when she was about to be born, we went shopping for pediatricians. And one of the questions we asked the pediatricians was, will you prescribe over the phone? And most of them, assuming that we wanted convenience, said yes. And we'd say, well, thank you, we'll call you back. We came upon one who said no. I will not prescribe any substance for any patient without a medical examination. We said, good, we'd like to interview you. And we went in and talked to her, and we told her why we were concerned. We said, look, we don't know whether or not there might be a genetic factor in alcoholism. We do know that the baby's father is an alcoholic who is sober in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that there's a possibility that this child is going to be unusually sensitive to sedative drugs. And the doctor then said she understood, and we hired her, and she's been Julie's doctor for 2.5 years. At one point, I think it was the annual examination, we took the kid in, and the nurse said it was obvious to her that Julie had good care and a loving home. And you know, I have a hard time telling you this because it still breaks me up. I know that that doctor, in the course of her practice, sees the neglect and abuse that are the unavoidable consequence of alcoholism in the family. And I know that somewhere on Julie's chart there's a note that says that her father is a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I know that her nurse said that it's apparent from looking at the kid that the kid is getting good care in a fairly normal home. And I know that that's a miracle that could not have happened without you. And I know that if the only thing that doctor ever knows about our fellowship is that one of her patients gets good care and has a parent in Alcoholics Anonymous, that may be one of the most powerful 12-step calls I'll ever make. And I know that that would not have been possible without your help. I like to remind myself that it is because a loving God works through people like you that I'm here and sober today. And for that, I thank you.